Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:46 p.m. That is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 7th, and it was a particularly eventful day on markets. I thought I would kick off and look at Tesla because it's been offering such clear relative strength compared to the wider market, but it is pulling, or at least pausing here, in the region of the upper side of its more than year-long range. But against a background where the stock market has been pulling back rather aggressively, then it's quite likely that short-term overbought conditions on just about anything are going to be unwound. Well, we had a nice bounce yesterday on Wall Street, and it was completely unwound in here today. And if we look at the Nasdaq, it's held a sequence of lower rally highs since the peak in October, and that remains intact. Now the next question is whether that low just above 6,400 is going to hold. Well, there are two big things that are animating markets. The first is the trade war, and the second is interest rates. So the trade war is obviously a major event, and not least because the CEO of Huawei, who happens to be the daughter of the founder, was arrested in Canada this week, and that is throwing a spanner in the works in terms of the relations between the USA and China, considering that it was all smiles and handshakes at the G20 just on last weekend, and now we're at Friday and they're basically at each other's throats again. So this is, I think, another catalytic event here, that it is suggesting that this trade war is going to go on for a while longer, that the sides are still quite far apart. But what it clearly highlights is that the USA feels threatened by the intention by China to become a leader in terms of technological development. Now, this has to all be put into the context of there is the Made in China 2025 project. There is the stated objective by the Chinese administration to become the preeminent global economy by 2030. And these are very clearly stated policy objectives. So let's perhaps start to think about the world from a Chinese perspective. How do they get to where they want to be? Well, the first thing they have to do is to become a big economy with a domestic consumer market. Well, that, I think they can say, that has been achieved in the last 5 years. Companies like Alibaba, which are increasingly being subverted to the intentions of the Chinese economy, now is that's just about it's almost a downside key reversal this week. It's certainly an outside week, but it's clearly demonstrating resistance in the region of the trend mean. Well, that helps to highlight the fact that even the most successful of the private companies in China are the profit motivation is being subverted to Communist Party ideology. And from the perspective of an investor, that's really bad news. So a lot of people, and I've spoken with some very high net worth individuals who have got substantial, in fact, I spoke to one person over the summer who had just about all of their portfolio in China. Well, that doesn't look like a sensible way of looking at the global economy, considering the fact that when you think about governance, and let's be very clear, it really does all come back to governance. China does not have respect for minority shareholder interests. It does not have property rights, and it a respect for property rights, and it doesn't have an independent judiciary either. The one abiding characteristic of the Chinese economy from an investor's perspective over the course of the last 30 years was that it kept its paws off of the manufacturing sector. But that is now being questioned. Then you also have the fact that this flirtation with allowing private enterprise to grow and prosper within the economy is certainly coming under pressure as well. So, from an investor's perspective, quite whether one thinks that China is going to achieve its objective of becoming the preeminent global economy within the next 11 years or not, from an investor's perspective, this deterioration in standards of governance and the deterioration in the performance of assets is a big red flag. And that's, I think, one of the big points here. Well, if we then go back to that original question, what is it that you need to achieve in order to really become the preeminent global economy? Well, you do need that domestic consumer base, and China worked very hard over the last 5 or 6 years to achieve that. Well, and most particularly when we look at the growth of the online community and online payments and the demonetization of the economy, that's all occurred again in a very fluid motion over the course of the last few years. Next objective is to achieve a preeminent position within technological development. Well, China is investing heavily in research and development. They are launching a space probe to explore the dark side of the moon today. So that will tell us that they have got clear capability in terms of the space sector. There was the news story just last week that we have now to have designer babies. So that is clearly demonstrating that China is adept at manipulating DNA and is adept at using CRISPR gene editing technology. So quite what their objectives are on that front. Well, one thing we certainly know is that they have none of the moral qualms that the Judeo-Christian community have in the West. That's certainly another point. Then, of course, they are very much intent on developing a domestic semiconductor business, and there is nothing going to stop them from achieving that goal. Whether they have to beg, borrow, or steal the technology, it is going to happen. So, that is another clear step on the road to achieving global preeminence. Now, what's the next one? Well, very simply, it's pretty much impossible to be the biggest economy in the world and have a preeminent economic position if you're not energy independent or have a significant domestic energy supply source. Well, China doesn't have anywhere close to the oil infrastructure it requires to achieve that particular goal. But what they do have is factories. And what China is very clearly, and what their objective has been for a fair amount of time already, has been to, and I've got a lot of different pages open here, but what I want to bring to your attention is the fact that China is investing incredibly heavily in the cobalt sector. And that's one of the more important facts, is that we may think about that in terms of whether it is a boondoggle or not, in terms of the investment in what is required to become the biggest producer of batteries in the world. Lots of people are thinking about that in terms of China wanting to become a dominant force in the production of electric vehicles. But there is an additional aspect to it, that if China can become the biggest producer of batteries in the world and therefore wean its economy off of oil, then that will achieve the dual purpose of becoming energy independent. And in order to become the preeminent global economy, that is obviously what they need. So that's, I think, a rather important set of characteristics here. So when we start to think about it in those terms, well, China is very clearly moving towards its stated objectives. Well, we can think about the trade war in on two fronts. One is that it's aimed at trying to get China to abide by the norms set out by the WTO, and that's been so far relatively unsuccessful. The other, of course, is to blunt this attempt by China to become the greatest, or the an additional superpower, or the preeminent force within the global economy. And that, if we look at it in through that lens, then that's obviously what the objective of this trade war is. So there it has been a hiatus in terms of the additional tariffs that were planned, and it's not now going to happen until March, but it's virtually certain that there will be additional tariffs because this is a clear objective of the trade war is to try and blunt China's economic progress. And the one thing that can do that would be to attack its manufacturing sector and its export market. One of the reasons that China has been able to engage in such enormous spending is because it has got this massive current account surplus. Well, one of the things that can be done to blunt its advance is to reduce that current account surplus. Well, when we look then at some of those Chinese assets, well, the first one, of course, is the renminbi. And the renminbi had strengthened for the first part of this week. And when we look at what's going on in here right now, then it's certainly pausing around the 7 area, and it is unwinding its oversold condition relative to the trend mean. But the last thing the Chinese want is a strong currency, most particularly if there is any kind of threat to their manufacturing sector. So that's, I think, an important characteristic. When we look at how the rest of the emerging markets look on China's currency, well, they are enormously dependent on competitiveness with the renminbi. So the MSCI Emerging Markets Currency Index had got right back up to the region of the trend mean over the course of the last few months, but its ability to rally further from here is very much contingent on at least the renminbi staying stable. And I think that is particularly unlikely, considering that we're seeing an additional selling pressure starting to come through. Of course, the other big point is that there is a couple of ways of thinking. The first is that I think a lot of people have been talking about that this is the beginning of a new Cold War, but I think that that is rather blinkered. What we are in fact seeing is that China has been engaged in a Cold War for much of the last decade. It is simply that now, instead of ignoring the threat, that more countries are starting to wake up to it. In fact, the Cold War has been going on. It's just been one-sided for the last decade. Now it's two-sided. Well, the A-share index has been trending down all year, and it was in mildly positive territory in here today, but it needs a clear government catalyst. Bull markets in China are state-sponsored, just like everything else, and it's not going to rally until we see a clear catalyst from the government. The very fact that there is, I think, increasing evidence that they are supporting the banking sector is potentially also a reflection of just how weak it is, that they are supporting the banking sector and just about nothing else. So when, for example, we look at the Shenzhen B shares, which doesn't have any banks in it, well, then we get a true perspective on just how much pressure the domestic economy is under right now. And China has got a mountain of debt. So when we look at, for example, the Shanghai Property Index, it had rallied pretty impressively over the course of the last 2 months. But now the big question is whether it's going to be able to sustain a move above the trend mean. This is a very big question for the property index. Well, then if we look at the kinds of companies that have got businesses that represent significant parts of their revenue attached to China, well, this week in Boeing, we've had a very large downward dynamic. And this is increasingly looking like a type 2 top formation. We have the progression of, we still have the, well, until quite recently, we had the progression of higher reaction lows, but we had the acceleration, then the loss of momentum, the failed upside breaks. Now we're getting the massive reactions against the prevailing trend. And considering the fact that the share just about, well, more than doubled, in fact, in 2017, well, it does suggest that there's a lot of fat on the price here that could get shaved off. Now, when we look at, for example, Caterpillar, well, considering its reliance on the mining sector, it's been trending down all year and pulled back violently again from the region of the trend mean in here today. Well, Apple has got a substantial franchise in China. It also has a substantial manufacturing sector in China. Well, the share has been pulling back violently over the course of the last 6 weeks, and there is no indication yet that it is over. Well, on one front, China is reliant on the kind of business that Apple is bringing in terms of manufacturing and the jobs that it is providing. But at the same, the other side of that equation is Apple is generating a lot of its profits from China. And when we look here at this figure for the greater China area, well, out of $265 billion in revenue, almost $52 billion of that is coming from China. So when they say greater China, what they're really meaning is China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. Well, considering the size of those markets, it's the domestic Chinese market that is the one that is really generating all of this revenue. So that's, I think, a big point here, that this is a risk that China may not kick Apple out, but they're going to be releasing their HomePods in China in the beginning of next year. And just how quickly those are taken up is going to be a measure of Chinese consumer appetite for overseas shares. Well, Tesla is also looking at opening a factory in China in order to get over the substantial tariffs that are put on its cars being exported there. So that is also a potential issue for the share, and not least as it's right at the upper side of its range. Then let's talk about what's going on in terms of interest rates. Well, the yield curve spread contracted pretty violently for a couple of days this week, and it's currently around 13.5 basis points. There has been an inversion in terms of the 2-year and the 5-year. What I've been pointing out is that when we look at the TIPS spread, it does tend to become inverted early. So, for example, when we look at when it initially became inverted, it was in October of 2005, and the yield curve spread, let me just find the right button for that, the yield curve spread became inverted in November. So that tells us that we have a lead indicator from the TIPS spread, and what that is beginning to suggest is that inflation is not a problem. In fact, it may potentially be the other way around, that there is the potential for deflationary forces to take hold if the TIPS spread is so heavily inverted. And that brings us to the question of what is it that the Fed is going to do with interest rates? Because it's something that the Fed is wont to do, is that they tend to be too late in raising interest rates and too late in cutting them. And it is in that fact of too late in cutting them is what tends to create the kind of tightness in conditions that really weighs on markets. Well, the 2-year yield is now unwinding its oversold condition relative to the trend mean, and there is a clear, I think, sign that it is going to at least unwind another 20 basis points. Well, what that is now beginning to price in is that if, in fact, the Federal Reserve does raise interest rates in December, that it may be the last one. That is increasingly what the bond market is starting to price in. And if that is indeed the case, well, it may be the kind of catalyst that the stock market is waiting for. We've had some very, very big dynamics in the market over the course of the last month. This has been a very choppy market, and choppy markets after a run-up like we've seen over the course of the last decade are not welcome. One of the more important points is that this has been a significant loss of momentum. And I'm very much reminded of the kind of condition we had with gold in approximately 2012 or 13. If we go back and think about what was the argument that was going on with gold back then, we had had an acceleration. There was a period of time when gold did go vertical, and the S&P did not do that. If we were looking for any index that had evidence of a real acceleration, it was the Dow Jones. But by the time we rolled around to 2012, well, there was this argument going on, and the argument was simple enough. It was that, is this a top or is it a continuation pattern? Well, the people who had been early buyers of gold had sat through 18-month consolidations before. So it peaked in September. And when we think about the fact that it was in September that it was breaking out, and after these lengthy consolidations, it was breaking out in September, and it was the September of uneven years. So there was this rather idiosyncratic commonality to these moves. The argument was running that this was just another one of these lengthy 18-month consolidations. So the peak being in September, that by the time we had rolled around to the March period, people were thinking, well, is the price going to now break higher? That it's been going sideways for 18 months, and if it's going to go up, well, then this is about when that should happen. And the other point, of course, was that a big bull market should get more consistent the longer it persists for, because big bull markets suck in investors from all over the world, which creates a wider imbalance between supply and demand. And therefore, when you get a loss of uptrend consistency after a particularly consistent period, that tells us that that widening imbalance between supply and demand is no longer working. So that also has to raise the question whether we are not then getting top formation development. So as long as the market is ranging, then you can still have the argument. But if it is a top, then we have to have an exit strategy. That you may still think that the market is going to go higher, but you do need to then have an exit strategy. Generally speaking, this is something we also talk about at the chart seminar. It's that people are most diligent with their stops after a big decline, whereas they really should be more diligent with their stops before the big decline. So that was the argument that was going on, and it was a very big argument. Now, if we go and think about what exactly have we had in the stock market over the course of the last decade? Well, We have had some very choppy action, particularly in 2010 and 2011, and again in 2015 and 2016. And then the market really trended really beautifully, consistently, all the way through from the presidential election in 2016 through to the peak in January. And the Dow Jones did accelerate towards the end. And now we have this loss of momentum. We have failed upside breaks. And the market has now held a sequence of lower rally highs since that peak that we had in September. Well, we still have the same argument. The same argument today is that is this another medium-term correction like we saw in 2015 or 2016? I saw a report today that JP Morgan is anticipating that the S&P 500 will be at 3,100 within a year. So I think that's ambitious. But what it does tell you is that there is still this argument going on that this is not just a that this is just a medium-term pause and that the market is going to resolve on the upside. And it is likely to be interest rate dependent because the trade war is certainly going on, and that is one of the factors that's influencing China. But its interest rate policy is probably the more important fact for the USA. And the fact that you do have the Federal Reserve raising interest rates, but at the same time reducing the size of its balance sheet. Well, then that's a big difference because in 2015 and 2016, the size of the balance sheet had stopped going up, but it was not going down. Whereas they've shaved almost 400 million, excuse me, 400 billion dollars off the size of the balance sheet this year. That represents quantitative tightening, and it's the clearest demonstration that we have of why we have an uptick in volatility. This has been a liquidity-fueled bull market, and quantitative tightening represents the withdrawal of that liquidity. Well, if we think about who are the main liquidity providers in the economy, well, one is the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve is by far the biggest provider of liquidity, and right now they are taking money out of the system. So that is draining liquidity from a bull market that has been dependent on liquidity. Then we have the banking sector. Well, the banking sector is dependent on the yield curve for margins, that when you have a wide margin between the short end and the long end, then they can borrow short and lend long and make money hand over fist. But when the yield curve flattens, let alone inverts, then banks don't make any money. And if they're not making money, then they are not extending loans, or they're becoming a lot pickier with who they should make those loans to. So that's an additional source of strife. And when we look at the S&P 500 banks index, it is pulling back from the region of the trend mean and doing so this week in a dynamic manner. So this is increasingly looking like a medium-term top. But the S&P 500 banks index is certainly not the worst performing bank index. In fact, it's probably one of the best. European banks are not just trending down. They're trending down with vigor. There is a clear indication that people are selling these and selling them with enthusiasm. This is the kind of thing where people say, "Just get me out." Well, Deutsche Bank is in all kinds of trouble. They have an enormous derivatives book, and I think the world has learned its lesson from Lehman that they're not going to let the difficulties that Deutsche Bank has result in a bankruptcy and the forced closing of all those derivatives. Because if that were to happen, well, then we would have a market crash. very similar to what we had in 2007 and 2008. I just don't think that that's going to happen. I think it's a much more likely scenario that Deutsche Bank is going to be nationalized, because Germany has nationalized just about every other bank. So that looks to be, I think, perhaps the most likely scenario. In either case, investors are going to get burned, and as if they haven't been burned enough already. Well, this is another point that we have the interest rate environment, which has been tightening up. And in the USA, this monetary accommodation has been replaced by fiscal stimulus. But the fiscal stimulus needs to be persistently replenished. And that's a challenge, to say the least, because you need to find willing buyers for your bonds. Well, the 10-year Treasury yield is now back below the trend mean. With strife in the stock market, people are starting to buy it. I'm starting to see news stories about the risk parity strategy, but risk parity works in both directions. If bonds are going up, then they'll short the equity, and that's exactly what we're seeing right now. The Russell 2000, because small cap companies tend to be more interest rate sensitive, has been leading on the downside, and it was at a new reaction low in here today. Well, we can't say that for any of the primary indices, but the Russell 2000 has been leading on the downside, and that's at an interest rate sensitive sector, and the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index is also an interest rate sensitive sector and pulled back in a very dynamic manner from the region of the trend mean in here this week. This looks like a type 2 top with right-hand extension characteristics. So it's going to require some very meaningful catalyst to turn things around. Potentially, the Federal Reserve not raising interest rates but cutting them would be a potential catalyst, but at least pausing. If they decided they were not going to raise interest rates and simply pause, that would probably be the best, one of the better points for the market. What is, I think, rather interesting is that we're seeing some quite concerted pressure coming onto the market right now before the yield curve has actually inverted, because everybody knows now what an inverted yield curve means. I remember back in 2006, there was a lot of argument about whether it was a reliable lead indicator or whether it would work on that occasion or not. Well, there's a lot less argument about it on this occasion. And if you do believe that there's going to be a recession in anywhere from 6 to 18 months from now, well, what people are obviously concluding is that now is the time to sell. I think that's one of the main differences on this occasion. The one thing that we have to potentially be alert to is that because people are always fighting the last war, the one lesson that everyone has learned from the last recession was that the yield curve spread was a reliable lead indicator, and nobody wants to get caught in the kind of downdraft that we saw in 2008. So they're selling early, and I think that is potentially what we're seeing today. When we look at the performance of what are classically considered to be the defensive sectors, well, then utilities are doing better, and they have been really a tower of strength on a relative basis. McDonald's was in negative territory today, but it was at new all-time highs. Pepsi, which produces both soft drinks and snacks, was down in here this week, but it was at a new all-time high last week. Coca-Cola, having really done nothing for much of the last few years, is also in the region of its all-time high. Under Armour, which is trading on an aggressive multiple, well, some of these shares have already pulled back in a very dynamic manner. They're still trading on the potential that this is going to be a blowout holiday season, and I think that it will because we have not yet seen a pullback for the consumer in the USA. Unemployment is still at a record low. The continuing claims index has been really quite low for and has been trending down for a prolonged period. Now, it's hard to imagine that we're going to have a recession without unemployment increasing, but that's likely to be a coincident indicator rather than a potential lead indicator. What is a potential lead indicator is that high yield spreads have started to rise. Well, it's usually we get a substantial lead that, for example, high yield spreads started to rise in 2014, but it wasn't really until the middle of 2015 that we started to see strife in the stock market. So I wonder, and this is very much an open question because we simply will not have an answer until we have further evidence, but that potentially the one thing that people have learned is that these are reliable lead indicators, and when they start to move, that you need to start to get busy. If you there usually what you would anticipate is that, especially if we look at the yield curve spread, that when the yield curve first becomes inverted, for example, back in 1998, it just about went inverted, and then we had a massive rally over the course of the next year and a half. And then it was mildly inverted in 2005, but the market didn't peak for another year and a half, 2 years. So if we do in fact get an inverted yield curve, well, there is the possibility that the market could rally for another year before we get the eventual peak. But what we are presented with right now is a very large pullback. If we look at what did the S&P 500 look like in 2005, well, the market had been pausing for just about all of 2005, but it had held this upward bias, and then it broke out. Well, what that tells us is that if we now look at the market, we've been rallying for 10 years already. So the time when we may or we could have punctuated this advance with a recession was probably back in 2014. But we still have the sequence of higher reaction lows. Now, if we're thinking about this, going back and thinking about the example with compared to gold, then this is the time to be thinking about an exit strategy. It doesn't necessarily mean that we need to be selling right away, but we definitely need to be talking about an exit strategy. What is, if we then go and think about, can you describe this market action to a blind person? Well, we can definitely say that the pace of the advance did pick up at the end of 2017, and we have had a significant loss of momentum and a big failed upside break a couple of months ago. And now the market is pulling back violently from the region of the trend mean. Well, in the event that it breaks down to new lows, I think we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the downside until or unless we see clear upward dynamics. That's the I think that has to be the conclusion here, that there is no point in getting I think wrapped up in ideology. When we look at the Dow Gold ratio, for example, it has been doing phenomenally well over the course of the last few years, but now gold is turning back to outperformance and the Dow Jones is pulling back. Well, this has been something that a lot of people have been waiting for. This was one of the things that people were looking at, and they were asking that question: was this rally similar to what we saw between 1975 and 1976. Well, the very length of the rally that we've had in the Dow Gold ratio, which bottomed in 2011, so it's been rallying now for 7 years, I think that really does put paid to the contention that this rally is similar to what we saw in 75 and 76. But that doesn't mean that we can't have a correction, that there is substantial potential here that gold can move to a position of outperformance. And it is now pushing back above the trend mean. And the most important thing that gold prices have done in the course of the last 4 years has been to break the downtrend in 2016. And this has been a very lengthy period of right-hand extension. But if gold can sustain a move back above the trend mean, well then, the potential for it to go right back up and test that $1,400 area is definitely going to be bolstered. And then there's the potential that it's going to break out. Because when we think about what the policy response is going to be if we do, in fact, go into a recession sooner rather than later, and personally, I think that it is still more likely that we're going to have a recession in the latter half of 2019 or the beginning of 2020. But we know what this policy response is going to be. Then there is the potential that the USA is going to have negative interest rates, that the ECB's quantitative easing program is going to go into overdrive, that the appetite for fiscal austerity is going to fall away. When we look at the fact that we have rising populist movements all over the world, that's it's something that I've been talking about for a year. But it's very clear that this is simply symptomatic of a wider malaise, that people are not electing populist. And it was Narendra Modi was the first of the populist people to be elected, because a majority of the population had become completely disillusioned with their lot in life, and they were voting for change. Well, that's what they got with Narendra Modi. Now, you have Donald Trump, you have Brexit, you have Bolsonaro in Brazil and AMLO in Mexico. And now you have the red vests. I called them red jackets earlier on this week, which is a kind of wasp, but they're certainly stinging Macron at the moment. When we look at Europe, and we think about what the epicenters of risk are, well, Europe has been the clear underperformer throughout the entire bull market. If we think about the fact that the index bottomed in 2009 at approximately 166 points, well, the value today is just about double that. Whereas the S&P 500 is multiples of what its low was. So Europe has continued to underperform. It has a clear internal struggle. Austerity has been forced on hundreds of millions of people in an ideological effort to try and align debt-to-GDP ratios so that a federal Europe could be imposed without a vote. And that is starting to come apart at the seams for the simple reason that you cannot expect hundreds of millions of people to endure lower standards of living for a decade with no end in sight. And the fiscal austerity that has characterized Europe is, I think, rapidly coming to an end. That the USA has been leading in terms of transitioning from monetary policy stimulus to fiscal policy stimulus. The UK has adopted fiscal stimulus, and it is only a matter of time before lots of other countries engage in the same kind of activity. There is also the prospect that China is going to do the same thing. Well, the other point, of course, is that one of the other things that has been reducing liquidity in the market has been the strength of the dollar. Well, the dollar has started to pull back, but not in a particularly dynamic manner on the dollar index, for the simple reason that Europe has got a lot more problems than the USA does. When we look at the Asia dollar index, it had been rallying earlier this week and then was not quite able to hold the rally through to the end of the week. But if we do start to see some of the dollar strength ebbing, well, then that is likely to extend liquidity out into the rest of the world. When we look at my measure of central bank total assets, then it did tick upwards over the course of the last few weeks. That's more to do with the relative weakness of the US dollar than any other factor. And this has already been the biggest contraction on this index since at least 2002. So the quantitative easing has been the causal factor behind all of the volatility that we've seen. And therefore, it is going to have to be the end of quantitative tightening that will eventually turn this ship around. But until that happens, then I think we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the downside. There is enough strife in Europe, enough challenges facing China, and that there are growing headwinds for the US economy that are likely to contribute to additional volatility right across markets. Now, when we think about what is it if there really is a secular bull market, and I do think there is, even though we are due a hiatus, and there is no secular bull market is not punctuated by the occasional cyclical bear, well, this is looking like a cyclical bear. And there is no secular bull market that lasts for over 20 years that is not punctuated by the occasional recession, and we are due a recession. Well, what is it that's likely to pull us out of the recession? Well, autonomous vehicles are just starting. It might take a couple of years before they can really start to produce the kind of productivity gains that could really drive a recovery. Then we also have the evolution of the biotechnology sector, and that continues to happen at a really prodigious pace. We have the rollout of 5G, which is going to massively increase broadband speeds and create a whole new set of dynamics within the app sector and in artificial intelligence. Deep learning is something that's really only in its infancy because it's only quite recently that we've been inundated with data, and it's going to take some time to really commercialize these products. So those are the kinds of things that we can anticipate are going to lead us up and out of this malaise that is overtaking the market right now. And then, of course, we also have the emerging markets. Because if there's strife in China and pressure is likely to come to bear on companies to move their manufacturing, well, then India is likely to be a major beneficiary. But of course, it's unlikely to be completely immune from selling pressure right now. Then Vietnam is also positioning itself as a major destination for offshoring, and the index has at least paused over the last while. If we're looking for countries with big young populations, well, the Philippines is certainly one of those. And I think that it is also a potential beneficiary from the potential reshoring that is likely to occur from China. Well, if we're moving towards a position in the world where there is going to be more fiscal stimulus, then the question then is, what's next with Japan? Japan is now importing people, so that's one of the more important points, and it has so far held this move above 20,000. So as long as it's doing that, then there is the I think we can still conclude that this is a new secular bull market for Japan, but it does need to hold at least the sequence of higher reaction lows since 2013. When we look at the resources sector, well, China is by far the largest importer of industrial resources. And when we look at the LME Metals Index, then it has type 2 top characteristics with right-hand extension, and it was down again in here this week. So that's putting downward pressure on the resources sector. Oil is much less dependent on China and is more of a truly global commodity, and it's oversold. The fact that OPEC are removing supply from the market, the fact, in fact, I think much more important is that Canada is removing supply from the market. West Canadian Select was quite recently trading close to $10. That really tells us that Canada has got some significant issues with the profitability of its oil extraction. And its high cost producers are going to be the victims in what is a rolling secular bear market in energy prices. Well, we also heard this week that the USA is now a net oil exporter for the first time in decades. So that's a major change. If we're starting to think about the preeminent power in the world, then the USA has got a technology lead. They also have energy independence, and they have a large domestic consumer market. Well, those are the things it needs to protect, and that is why we have this trade war. So we certainly have challenges right now, and we're certainly starting to see evidence of topping activity in an increasing number of sectors. So the sectors that are doing best are highly defensive, but that alone tells us that people are getting rather scared by growth, and it is in the growth sector where people have got some of the biggest positions. So I think that we are in for some additional volatility. The fact that the market has been going sideways for just about all of this year, I think if we're going to predict what's going to happen next year, then the clearest conclusion is that we're not going to be ranging. That generally speaking, people tend to predict what they see. And what people see is ranging. And what I've seen over the course of the last few months has been a lot of reports predicting that the market is likely to range in 2019, and I really think that that is perhaps the least likely scenario. That we're either going to find support soon and rally, or the market is going to break downwards. And then the big question will be whether it will continue to encounter resistance in the region of the trend mean. So I think that is I want to I'm not accustomed to being a bear in the market. I do think that markets tend to rally more often than not, but we have to be alert to the loss of uptrend consistency, the increasing evidence of topping activity, and that this is one of those instances where we have to be particularly diligent about what an exit strategy should be. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.